can't test every teenager each year, month, hour, to determine whether they are mature enough yet to, say, vote. But it's worth doing so when it comes to a teenage murderer. In another contrarian view, the issue isn't whether a 17-year-old is as mature as an adult, but whether they are mature enough. Sandra Day O'Connor, in dissenting from the Roper decision, wrote, "The fact that juveniles are generally less culpable for their misconduct than adults does not necessarily mean that a 17-year-old murderer cannot be sufficiently culpable to merit the death penalty." Her emphasis. Another dissenter, the late Antonin Scalia, wrote that it is absurd to think that one must be mature enough to drive carefully, to drink responsibly, or to vote intelligently in order to be mature enough to understand that murdering another human being is profoundly wrong. Amid these differing opinions, everyone, including O'Connor and Scalia, agrees that there exist age-related boundaries on free will. Everyone's homunculus was once too young to have its adult powers. Maybe it wasn't tall enough yet to reach all the control dials. Maybe it was distracted from its job by fretting about that gross pimple on its forehead. And that needs to be considered during legal judgments. Just as with piglets and pigs, it's just an issue of when a homunculus is old enough. The nature and magnitude of brain damage. Essentially, everyone working with a model of mitigated free will accepts that if there is enough brain damage, responsibility for a criminal act goes out the window. Even Stephen Morse of the University of Pennsylvania, a strident critic of neuroscience in the courtroom, much more later, concedes, "Suppose we could show that the higher deliberative centers in the brain seem to be disabled in these cases. If these are people who cannot control episodes of gross irrationality, we've learned something that might be relevant to the legal ascription of responsibility." In this view, mitigating biological factors are relevant if the capacity for reasoning has been grossly impaired. Thus, if someone had their entire frontal cortex destroyed, you probably shouldn't hold them responsible for their actions, because their rationality is grossly impaired when deciding their own courses of action. But the issue then becomes where a line is drawn on a continuum. What if 99% of the frontal cortex is destroyed? What if 98%? This is of great practical importance, since a large percentage of death row inmates have a history of damage to the frontal cortex, particularly of the most disabling type, namely early in life. In other words, amid differing opinions about where a line should be drawn, believers in mitigated free will agree that massive amounts of brain damage overwhelm a homunculus, while it should be expected to handle at least some damage. Responsibility at the level of the brain and at the social level. The renowned neuroscientist Michael Gazzaniga, one of the leading lights and elders of the field, has taken an extremely odd path in writing, "Free will is an illusion, but you're still responsible for your actions." This is expounded at length in a challenging book of his, Who's in Charge? Free Will and the Science of the Brain. Gazzaniga fully accepts the entirely material nature of the brain, but nonetheless sees room for responsibility. Responsibility exists at a different level of organization, the social level, not in our determined brains. I think either he is actually saying, "Free will is an illusion, but for practical reasons, we are still going to hold you responsible for your actions," or he is hypothesizing some manner of homunculus that exists only at a social level. In response to the latter idea, the pages of this book show how our social world is ultimately as much a product of our determined, materialist brains as are our simple motor movements. The time course of decision-making. Another well-established fault line in the stance of mitigated free will is that our capacity for free will moves to the forefront with decisions that are slow and deliberative, whereas biological factors may push free will aside in split-second decision situations. In other words, the homunculus is not always sitting right at the helm in the bunker. Instead, it occasionally wanders off to grab a snack, and if something exciting suddenly arises, Those neurons may fire off commands to muscles and produce a behavior before the homunculus can rush back and hit that big red button on the control panel. Issues of getting to the red button in time intersect with issues of the adolescent brain. A number of critics of Roper versus Simmons, starting with O'Connor in her dissenting opinion, noted a seeming contradiction. The American Psychological Association, APA, had filed an amicus curiae brief in the case, emphasizing that adolescents, i.e. their brains, are so immature that they can't be held to adult criminal standards with sentencing. Turns out that the same APA had filed a brief some years earlier in a different case, emphasizing that adolescents are sufficiently mature that they should be able to choose whether to have an abortion, even without parental consent. Well, that's a bit awkward, and it sure makes the APA and its ilk appear to be flip-flopping along ideological grounds, O'Connor charged. Lawrence Steinberg, whose research on adolescent brain development was covered heavily in Chapter 7, and whose work was influential in the Roper versus Simmons decision, offers a logical resolution. Deciding whether to have an abortion involves logical reasoning about moral, social, and interpersonal issues, stretching out over days to weeks. In contrast, deciding whether to, say, shoot someone can involve issues of impulse control over the course of seconds. The frontal immaturity of the adolescent brain is more pertinent to split-second issues of impulse control than to slow, deliberative reasoning processes. Or in a mitigated free will framework, rapid-fire, impulsive behaviors can occur while the homunculus has gone to the bathroom. Causation and compulsion. Some proponents of mitigated free will distinguish between the concepts of causation and compulsion. In a way that feels a bit nebulous, the former involves every behavior having been caused by something, of course, but the latter reflects only a subset of behaviors being really, really caused by something, something that compromises rational, deliberative processes. In this view, some behaviors are more deterministically biological than others. This has been relevant to schizophrenic delusions. Suppose someone suffering from schizophrenia has auditory hallucinations, including a voice telling him to commit a crime. He does so. Some courts have viewed this as not mitigating. If your friend suggests that you mug someone, the law expects you to resist, even if it's an imaginary friend in your head. But others see distinctions depending on qualities of the auditory hallucinations. In that view, if a schizophrenic individual commits a crime because a voice in his head demanded it, yes, his act was caused by that voice, but that doesn't excuse the crime. In contrast, consider a schizophrenic individual committing a crime because thundering choruses of taunting, threatening, cajoling voices in his head, complete with baying hellhounds and choirs of trombones playing loud atonal music, command him every waking moment to do the crime. When he succumbs and does so, it is deemed more excusable, because those voices constituted a compulsion to act. Footnote. Many chapters ago I made reference to the Son of Sam murder spree in 1976 and the arrest of David Berkowitz. In his defense, Berkowitz claimed that he was demonically possessed and had been commanded to murder, not by Satan, Hitler, Al Capone, or Genghis Khan, but instead by his neighbor's dog. He was convicted and given 6 consecutive life sentences. Thus, in this view, even a sensible homunculus can lose it and agree to virtually anything just to get the hellhounds and trombones to stop. Starting a behavior versus halting it. It is virtually ordained that any discussion of volition and biology eventually considers the Libet experiment. In the 1980s, neuroscientist Benjamin Libet of UCSF reported something fascinating. A subject is hooked up to an EEG machine, which monitors patterns of electrical excitation in the brain. She sits quietly, looking at a clock. She has been instructed to flick her wrist whenever she feels like it and to note the time, down to the second, when she decided to do so. Libet would identify something in the EEG data called a readiness potential, a signal from the motor cortex and supplementary premotor areas that a movement would soon be initiated. And consistently, readiness potentials appeared about half a second before the reported time of the conscious intent to move. Interpretation? Your brain decided to move before you were even aware of it. Thus, how can you claim to have chosen when to move, evidence of free will, if the cascade of neural signaling culminating in movement started before you consciously chose? Free will is an illusion. Naturally, this finding generated speculation, controversy, replications, elaborations, refutations, and nuances that are beyond me. One criticism concerned a necessary limitation of the approach. In this view, there's free will, you freely decide when to move your wrist, and that readiness potential is a consequence of your decision. What's the 500 millisecond delay in that case? That's the lag time between the instant when the decision to move first occurs and when A, attention is then focused on the clock, and B, the position of the second hand is interpreted. In other words, the supposed half-second lag is an artifact of the experimental design, not a real thing. Other criticisms concerned the ambiguity of feeling that you intend to move. Other criticisms are more arcane than I can follow. A very different interpretation of the finding was offered, interestingly, by Libet. Yes, maybe your brain prepares to initiate a behavior before there is conscious awareness of the decision, meaning that your belief that you consciously chose to move is wrong. But in that lag time is the potential to consciously choose to veto that action. In the pithy words of V.S. Ramachandran of Mirror Neuron Speculation in Chapter 14, we may not have free will, but we have free won't. Predictably, this intriguing counterinterpretation has fueled more discussions, experiments, and counter-counterinterpretations. For us, surveying different disputes concerning mitigated free will, this entire debate is about the nature of a homunculus's control panel. How many of its buttons and switches and dials that go up to 11 are involved in initiating a behavior versus halting it? Thus, a view of mitigated free will makes room for both biological causation of behavior and free will, and all the discussions merely concern where lines in the sand are drawn and how inviolate they are. This prepares us to consider what I think is the most important line-drawing debate. You must be so smart versus you must have worked so hard. Stanford psychologist Carol Dweck has done groundbreaking work on the psychology of motivation. In the late 1990s, she reported something important. Kids do a task, take a test, something, where they do it well. You then praise them in one of two ways. What a great score! You must be so smart. Or, what a great score! You must have worked so hard. When you praise kids for working hard, they tend to work harder the next time, show more resilience, enjoy the process more, and become more likely to value the accomplishment for its own sake, rather than for the grade. Praise kids for being smart, and precisely the opposite occurs. When it becomes all about being smart, effort begins to seem suspect, beneath you. After all, if you're really so smart, you shouldn't have to work hard. You glide. You don't sweat and grunt. Beautiful work that has achieved cult status among many thoughtful parents of gifted kids who want to understand when their child's smarts shouldn't come into the picture. Why do "you're so smart" and "you work so hard" have such different effects? Because they fall on either side of one of the deepest lines drawn by believers in mitigated free will. It is the belief that one assigns aptitude and impulse to biology and effort and resisting impulse to free will. It's cool to see natural ability in action. The great all-around athlete who has never seen pole vaulting before watches it once, tries it once, and soars like a pro. Or the singer whose voice has always had a natural timbre that evokes emotions you never knew existed. Or that student in your class who obviously just gets it, 2 seconds into your explaining something really abstruse. That's impressive. But then there's inspiring. When I was a kid, I repeatedly read a book about Wilma Rudolph. She was the fastest female runner in the world in 1960, an Olympian who became a civil rights pioneer. Definitely impressive. But consider that she was born prematurely, underweight, one of 22 kids in a poor Tennessee family, and, get this, at age 4 got polio, resulting in a leg brace and a twisted foot. Polio. She was crippled by polio. And she defied every expert's expectations, worked and worked and worked through the pain, and became the fastest there was. That's inspiring. In many domains, we can sort of grasp the materialist building blocks of natural ability. Someone has the optimal ratio of slow twitch to fast twitch muscle fibers, producing a natural pole vaulter. Or has vocal cords with a perfect degree of velvety peach fuzz, I'm winging it here, to produce an extraordinary voice. Or the ideal combination of neurotransmitters, receptors, transcription factors, and so on, producing a brain that rapidly intuits abstractions. And we can also perceive the building blocks in someone who is merely okay or lousy at any of these. But Rudolph-esque accomplishments seem different. You're exhausted, demoralized, and it hurts like hell, but you push on. You want to take an evening off, see a movie with a friend, but resume studying. There's that temptation. No one's looking. Everyone else does it, but you know it's wrong. It seems so hard, so improbable to think of those same neurotransmitters, receptors, or transcription factors when considering feats of willpower. There seems a much easier answer. You're seeing the Calvinist work ethic of a homunculus sprinkled with the right kind of fairy dust. Here's a great example of this dualism. Recall Jerry Sandusky, the Penn State football coach who was a horrific serial child molester. After his conviction came an opinion piece on CNN. Writing under the provocative heading of "Do Pedophiles Deserve Sympathy?", James Cantor of the University of Toronto reviewed the neurobiology of pedophilia. For example, it runs in families in ways suggesting genes play a role. Pedophiles have atypically high rates of brain injuries during childhood. There's evidence of endocrine abnormalities during fetal life. Does this raise the possibility that a neurobiological die is cast, that some people are destined to be this way? Precisely. Cantor concludes, one cannot choose to not be a pedophile. Brave and correct. And then Cantor does a stunning mitigated free will long jump. Does any of that biology lessen the condemnation and punishment that Sandusky deserved? No. One cannot choose to not be a pedophile, but one can choose to not be a child molester. This establishes a dichotomy of what things are supposedly made of. Biological stuff, destructive sexual urges. Homuncular grit, resisting acting upon them. Biological stuff, delusionally hearing voices. Homuncular grit, resisting their destructive commands. Biological stuff, proclivity toward alcoholism. Homuncular grit, not drinking. Biological stuff, having epileptic seizures. Homuncular grit, not driving if you didn't take your meds. Biological stuff, not all that bright. Homuncular grit, getting going when the going gets tough. Biological stuff, not the loveliest of faces. Homuncular grit, resisting getting that huge, hideous nose ring. Here are just a few of the things we've seen in this book that can influence homuncular grit. Blood glucose levels, the socioeconomic status of your family of birth, a concussive head injury, sleep quality and quantity, prenatal environment, stress and glucocorticoid levels, whether you're in pain, if you have Parkinson's disease and which medication you've been prescribed, perinatal hypoxia, your dopamine D4 receptor gene variant, if you have had a stroke in your frontal cortex, if you suffered childhood abuse, how much of a cognitive load you've borne in the last few minutes, your MAOA gene variant, if you're infected with a particular parasite, if you have the gene for Huntington's disease, lead levels in your tap water when you were a kid, if you live in an individualist or a collectivist culture. if you're a heterosexual male and there's an attractive woman around, if you've been smelling the sweat of someone who is frightened, on and on. Of all the stances of mitigated free will, the one that assigns aptitude to biology and effort to free will, or impulse to biology and resisting it to free will, is the most permeating and destructive. "You must have worked so hard" is as much a property of the physical universe and the biology that emerged from it as is "you must be so smart." And yes, being a child molester is as much a product of biology as is being a pedophile. To think otherwise is little more than folk psychology. But does anything useful actually come of this? As I noted, the most formidable skeptic of the relevance of neuroscience to the legal system is Stephen Morse, who has written extensively and effectively about the subject. He is the definitive advocate of free will being compatible with a deterministic world. He's fine with McNaughton and recognizes that there can be sufficient brain damage to compromise the notion of responsibility. Various causes can produce genuine excusing conditions, such as lack of rational or control capacity. But beyond those rare instances, he believes neuroscience offers little that should challenge the notion of responsibility. As he is quipped, "Brains don't kill people, people kill people." Morse epitomizes the skepticism about bringing neuroscience into the courtroom. For one thing, he viscerally cringes at how much of a fad neurolaw and neurocriminology have become. A wonderfully sardonic writer, he has announced the discovery of the disorder brain overclaim syndrome, whose sufferers have gotten carried away with the importance of neuroscience because they've been infected and inflamed by stunning advances in our understanding of the brain, causing them to make moral and legal claims that the new neuroscience does not entail and cannot sustain. One absolutely valid criticism of his is a narrow, practical one. This is the worry, aired earlier, that juries will give undue weight to neuroimaging data just because of how impressive the images are. Apropos of that, Morse has called neuroscience determinism du jour, grabbing the attention previously given to psychological or genetic determinism. The only thing different about neuroscience is that we have prettier pictures and it appears more scientific. Another valid criticism concerns findings in neuroscience usually merely being descriptive, e.g., brain region A projects to brain region Q, or correlative, e.g., elevated levels of neurotransmitter X and of behavior Z tend to go together. Data such as those don't disprove free will. In the words of philosopher Hilary Bock, "The claim that a person chose her action does not conflict with the claim that some neural processes or states caused it. It simply redescribes it." This is a point I've made throughout the book, namely that description and correlation are nice, but actual causal data are the gold standard, e.g., when you raise the levels of neurotransmitter X, behavior Z happens more often. That is the source of some of our most powerful demonstrations of the material basis of our more complex behaviors. For example, transcranial magnetic stimulation techniques that transiently activate or inactivate a part of the cortex can change someone's moral decision-making, decisions about punishment, or levels of generosity and empathy. That's causality. It is when we get to the issue of causality that Morse distinguishes between causation and compulsion. He writes, "Causation is neither an excuse, per se, nor the equivalent of compulsion, which is an excusing condition." Morse describes himself as a thoroughgoing materialist and states, "We live in a causal universe, which includes human action." But try as I might, I cannot see any way of making this distinction that does not tacitly require a homunculus that is outside the causal universe. A homunculus that can be overwhelmed by compulsion, but that can and should handle causation. In the words of philosopher Sean Nichols, "It seems like something has to give, either our commitment to free will, or our commitment to the idea that every event is completely caused by the preceding events." Despite these criticisms of his criticisms, my stance has a major problem, one that causes Morse to conclude that the contributions of neuroscience to the legal system are modest at best, and neuroscience poses no genuine, radical challenges to concepts of personhood, responsibility, and competence. The problem can be summarized in a hypothetical exchange. Prosecutor: So, Professor, you've told us about the extensive damage that the defendant sustained to his frontal cortex when he was a child. Has every person who has sustained such damage become a multiple murderer, like the defendant? Neuroscientist testifying for the defense: No. Prosecutor: Has every such person at least engaged in some sort of serious criminal behavior? Neuroscientist: No. Prosecutor: Can brain science explain why the same amount of damage produced murderous behavior in the defendant? Neuroscientist: No. The problem is that, even amid all these biological insights that allow us to be snitty about those silly homunculi, we still can't predict much about behavior. Perhaps at the statistical level of groups, but not when it comes to individuals. Explaining lots and predicting little. If a person's leg is fractured, how predictable is it that they will have trouble walking? I think it would be safe to predict something close to 100%. If they have serious inflammatory lung disease, how predictable is it that their breathing will be labored at times and that they will tire easily? Again, around 100%. Same for the effects of significant blockage of blood flow to the legs or extensive cirrhosis of the liver. Let's switch to the brain and neurological dysfunction. What if someone has had a brain injury and the neurons around the resulting scar tissue rewire so that they stimulate both themselves and one another? How predictable is it that the person will have a seizure? How about if they have congenital weaknesses in the walls of the blood vessels throughout the brain? How likely is a cerebral aneurysm at some point? How about if they have a mutation in the gene that causes Huntington's disease? How likely are they to have a neuromuscular disorder by age 60? Really high in all cases, probably approaching 100%. Let's incorporate behavior. If someone has extensive frontocortical damage, how predictable is it that you'd note something odd about them behaviorally after a 5-minute conversation? Something like 75%. Now let's consider a broader range of behaviors. How predictable is it that this person with frontal damage will do something horrifically violent at some point? Or that someone who was abused repeatedly as a child will become an abusive adult? That a soldier who went through a battle that killed his buddies will develop PTSD? That a person with the Montanvol, polygamous version of the vasopressin receptor gene promoter will have numerous failed marriages? That a person with a particular array of glutamate receptor subtypes throughout their cortex and hippocampus will have an IQ above 140? That someone raised with extensive childhood adversity and loss will have a major depressive disorder? All under 50%, often way under. So how do a fractured leg, inevitably impairing locomotion, and the non-inevitabilities of the previous paragraph differ? Do the latter somehow involve less biology? Is the point that the brain contains a non-biological homunculus, but that leg bones do not? Hopefully, after this many pages, the start of an answer is apparent. It's not that there's less biology in those circumstances related to social behavior. It's that it's qualitatively different biology. When a bone shatters, there's a relatively straight line of steps leading to inflammation and pain that will impair the person's gait, should he try to walk an hour later. That straight line of biology won't be altered by conventional variation in his genome, his prenatal hormone exposure, the culture he was raised in, or when he ate lunch. But as we've seen, all of those variables can influence social behaviors that shape our best and worst moments. The biology of the behaviors that interest us is, in all cases, multifactorial. That is the thesis of this book. Let's see what multifactorial means in a practical sense. Consider someone with frequent depression who is visiting a friend today, pouring her heart out about her problems. how much could you have predicted the global depression and today's behavior by knowing about her biology? Suppose knowing about her biology consisted only of knowing what version of the serotonin transporter gene she has. How much predictive power does that give you? As we saw in Chapter 8, not much, say 10%. What if knowing about her biology consists of knowing the status of that gene plus knowing if one of her parents died when she was a child? More, maybe 25%. How knowing her serotonin transporter gene status plus childhood adversity status plus whether she is living alone in poverty? Maybe up to 40%. Add knowledge of the average level of glucocorticoids in her bloodstream today. Maybe a bit more. Toss in knowing if she's living in an individualist or collectivist culture. Some more predictability. Know if she is menstruating, which typically exacerbates symptoms in seriously depressed women, making it more likely that they'll be socially withdrawn rather than reaching out to someone. Some more predictability. Maybe even above the 50% mark by now. Add enough factors, many of which, possibly most of which, have not yet been discovered, and eventually your multifactorial biological knowledge will give you the same predictive power as in the fractured bone scenario. Not different amounts of biological causation, different types of causation. The artificial intelligence pioneer Marvin Minsky once defined free will as internal forces I do not understand. People intuitively believe in free will, not just because we have this terrible human need for agency, but also because most people know next to nothing about those internal forces. And even the neuroscientist on the witness stand can't accurately predict which individual with extensive frontal damage will become the serial murderer, because science as a whole still knows only about a handful of those internal forces. Shattered bone, to inflammation, to constricted movement, is easy. Neurotransmitters, plus hormones, plus childhood, plus blank, plus isn't. Just to give a sense of how few baby steps we've taken, the maximal number of contributing variables identified in predicting depression is serotonin transporter status, plus childhood adversity status, plus adult social support status. That's it. That's about how far the literature has gotten. For frontal damage and antisocial violence, it's neurological status of frontal cortex, plus D4 dopamine receptor subtype, plus ADHD status. Another factor comes into play. When I go to the Web of Science, a search engine for scanning databases of papers published in science and medical journals. Under search terms, I put in oxytocin and trust, just to pick an example of the umpteen links between biology and social behavior that we've covered. And up comes the news that 193 papers have been published on the subject, most of which have been published in the last few years. Similar results searching for oxytocin and social behavior, or transcranial magnetic stimulation and decision-making, or brain and aggression. Our behaviors are constantly shaped by an array of subterranean forces. What these search results show is that most of these forces involve biology that, not that long ago, we didn't know existed. So what do we do with Minsky's definition of free will needing to be amended to internal forces I do not understand yet? How they will view us. If you still think there is mitigated free will, there are three possible routes to take at this juncture. To appreciate the first, let's briefly consider epilepsy. Scientists understand a lot about the neurological bases of seizures and how they involve firing with abnormally high frequency and synchrony. But not that long ago, say a century ago, epilepsy was viewed as a type of mental illness. And before that, it was thought by many to be a communicable, infectious disease. And at other times and places, it was thought to be caused by menstruation, or excessive sex, or excessive masturbation. But in 1487, two German scholars uncovered a cause of epilepsy that really seemed to hit the nail on the head. The two Dominican friars, Heinrich Kramer and Jakob Sprenger, published Malleus Maleficarum, Latin for Hammer of the Witches, the definitive treatise about why someone becomes a witch, how to identify them, and what to do with them. What was one of the surest ways to identify a witch? If they are seized by Satan, if they convulse from the malign power of the devil within them. Their guideline was the Gospel according to Mark, 9:14-29. A man brings his son to Jesus, saying there is something wrong with him, and asking Jesus to cure him. A spirit comes and seizes him, making him mute, and then that spirit throws him to the ground, where he foams at the mouth and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. The man presents his son, who is promptly seized by that spirit and falls to the ground, convulsing and foaming. Jesus perceives that the boy is infested with an unclean spirit and commands that vile spirit to come out and be gone. The seizing ceases. Thus, seizures were a sign of demonic possession, a certain marker of a witch. Malleus Maleficarum arrived in time to take advantage of mass production through the recently invented printing press. In the words of historian Geoffrey Russell, the swift propagation of the witch hysteria by the press was the first evidence that Gutenberg had not liberated man from original sin. The book was widely read and went through more than 30 editions over the subsequent century. Estimates are that from 100,000 to 1 million people were persecuted, tortured, or killed as witches in the aftermath. I don't think much of Cromer and Sprenger. My assumption is that they were sadistic monsters, but that could reflect my being influenced too much by the likes of The Name of the Rose or The Da Vinci Code. Maybe they were opportunists who reasoned that the book would make their careers. Maybe they were utterly sincere. Instead, I imagine a scenario of an evening during the late 15th century. A church inquisitor comes home from work, weary, burdened. His wife coaxes him to talk. "It was a usual day of condemning witches, but this one case bothered me. Everyone testified about this woman who falls and gnashes and convulses, a witch without a doubt. I don't feel sorry for her. No one told her to open wide for Satan. But she had these two beautiful kids. You should have seen them. Just so confused as to why their mother was being taken away. Distraught husband also. So that part was hard, seeing them suffer. But it is what it is. We burned her, of course." Burnings and killings and centuries were to pass until we in the West would have learned enough to say, "It's not her, it's her disease." Footnote. I specify in the West because this is by no means a universal interpretation, even today. We're only a first few baby steps into understanding any of this. So few that it leaves huge, unexplained gaps that perfectly smart people fill in with a homunculus. Nevertheless, even the staunchest believers in free will must admit that it is hemmed into tighter spaces than in the past. It's less than 2 centuries since science first taught us that the frontal cortex has something to do with appropriate behavior. Less than 70 years since we learned that schizophrenia is a biochemical disorder. Perhaps 50 years since we learned that reading problems of a type that we now call dyslexia aren't due to laziness, but instead involve microscopic cortical malformations. 25 since we learned that epigenetics alters behavior. The influential philosopher Daniel Dennett has written about the free will that is worth wanting. If there really is free will, it's getting consigned to domains too mundane to be worth the effort to want. Do I want briefs or boxer shorts today? Recall those searches showing the recentness of these scientific discoveries. If you believe that starting tonight, at midnight, something will happen and science will stop, that there will be no new publications, findings, or knowledge relevant to this book, that we now know everything there is, then it's clear what one's stance should be. There are some rare domains where the extremes of biological dysfunction cause involuntary changes in behavior, and we're not great at predicting who undergoes such changes. In other words, the homunculus is alive and well. But if you believe that there will be the accrual of any more knowledge, you've just committed to either the view that any evidence for free will ultimately will be eliminated, or the view that, at the very least, the homunculus will be jammed into ever tinier places. And with either of those views, you've also agreed that something else is virtually guaranteed. that people in the future will look back at us as we do at purveyors of leeches and bloodletting and trepanation, as we look back at the 15th century experts who spent their days condemning witches, that those people in the future will consider us and think, my God, the things they didn't know then, the harm that they did. Archaeologists do something impressive, reflecting disciplinary humility. When archaeologists excavate a site, they recognize that future archaeologists will be horrified at their primitive techniques, at the destructiveness of their excavating. Thus, they often leave most of a site untouched to await their more skillful disciplinary descendants. For example, astonishingly, more than 40 years after excavations began, less than 1% of the famed Qin Dynasty terracotta army in China has been uncovered. Those adjudicating trials don't have the luxury of adjourning for a century until we really understand the biology of behavior. But at the very least, the system needs the humility of archaeology, a sense that, above all else, we shouldn't act irrevocably. But what do we actually do in the meantime? Simple, which is easy for me to say, looking at the legal world from the soothing distance of my laboratory. Probably just three things. One is easy, one is very challenging to implement, and the third is nearly impossible. First, the easy one. If you reject free will and the discussion turns to the legal system, the crazy-making, inane challenge that always surfaces is that you do nothing about criminals, that they'd be free to walk the streets wreaking havoc. Let's trash this one instantly. No rational person who rejects free will actually believes this, would argue that we should do nothing because, after all, the person has frontal damage, or because, after all, evolution has selected for the damaging trait to traditionally be adaptive, or because, after all, people must be protected from individuals who are dangerous. The latter can no more be allowed to walk the streets than you can allow a car whose brakes are faulty to be driven. Rehabilitate such people if you can. Send them to the island of misfit toys forever if you can't, and they are destined to remain dangerous. Josh Green and Jonathan Cohen of Princeton wrote an extremely clear-headed piece on this. For the law, neuroscience changes nothing and everything. Where neuroscience and the rest of biology change nothing is in the continued need to protect the endangered from the dangerous. Now for the nearly impossible issue, the one that changes everything, the issue of punishment. Maybe, just maybe, a criminal must suffer punishment at junctures in a behaviorist framework as part of rehabilitation, part of making recidivism unlikely by fostering expanded frontal capacity. It is implicit in the very process of denying a dangerous individual their freedom by removing them from society. But precluding free will precludes punishment being an end in and of itself, punishment being imagined to balance the scales of justice. It is the punisher's mindset where everything must be changed. The difficulty of this is explored in the superb book, The Punisher's Brain, The Evolution of Judge and Jury, 2014, by Morris Hoffman, a practicing judge and legal scholar. He reviews the reasons for punishment. As we see from game theory studies, because punishment fosters cooperation, because it is in the fabric of the evolution of sociality, and most important, because it can feel good to punish, to be part of a righteous and self-righteous crowd at a public hanging, knowing that justice is being served. This is a deep, atavistic pleasure. Put people in brain scanners, give them scenarios of norm violations. Decision-making about culpability for the violation correlates with activity in the cognitive DLPFC. But decision-making about appropriate punishment activates the emotional VMPFC, along with the amygdala and insula. The more activation, the more punishment. The decision to punish, the passionate motivation to do so, is a frothy limbic state, as are the consequences of punishing. When subjects punish someone for making a lousy offer in an economic game, there's activation of dopaminergic reward systems. Punishment that feels just feels good. It makes sense that we've evolved such that it is limbic froth that is at the center of punishing, and that a pleasurable dopaminergic surge rewards doing so. Punishment is effortful and costly, ranging from foregoing a reward when rejecting a lowball offer in the ultimatum game, to our tax dollars paying for the dental plan of the prison guard who operates the lethal injection machine. That rush of self-righteous pleasure is what drives us to shoulder the costs. This was shown in one neuroimaging study of economic gameplay. Subjects alternated between being able to punish lousy offers at no cost and having to spend points they had earned to do so. And the more dopaminergic activation during no-cost punishment, the more someone would pay to punish in the other condition. Thus, the nearly impossible task is to overcome that. Sure, as I said, punishment would still be used in an instrumental fashion, to acutely shape behavior. But there is simply no place for the idea that punishment is a virtue. Our dopaminergic pathways will have to find their stimulation elsewhere. I sure don't know how best to achieve that mindset, but crucially, I sure do know we can do it, because we have before. Once, people with epilepsy were virtuously punished for their intimacy with Lucifer. Now, we mandate that if their seizures aren't under control, they can't drive. And the key point is that no one views such a driving ban as virtuous, pleasurable punishment, believing that a person with treatment-resistant seizures deserves to be banned from driving. Crowds of goitrous yahoos don't excitedly mass to watch the epileptic's driver's license being publicly burned. We've successfully banished the notion of punishment in that realm. It may take centuries, but we can do the same in all our current arenas of punishment. Which brings us to the huge practical challenge. The traditional rationales behind imprisonment are to protect the public, to rehabilitate, to punish, and finally to use the threat of punishment to deter others. That last one is the practical challenge, because such threats of punishment can indeed deter. How can that be done? The broadest type of solution is incompatible with an open society. Making the public believe that imprisonment involves horrific punishments when, in reality, it doesn't. Perhaps the loss of freedom that occurs when a dangerous person is removed from society must be deterrence enough. Perhaps some conventional punishment will still be needed if it is sufficiently deterring. But what must be abolished are the views that punishment can be deserved and that punishing can be virtuous. None of this will be easy. When contemplating the challenge to do so, it is important to remember that many, maybe even most of the people who are prosecuting epileptics in the 15th century were no different from us, sincere, cautious, and ethical, concerned about the serious problems threatening their society, hoping to bequeath their children a safer world. Just operating with an unrecognizably different mindset. The psychological distance from them to us is vast, separated by the yawning chasm that was the discovery of, it's not her, it's her disease. Having crossed that divide, the distance we now need to go is far shorter. It merely consists of taking that same insight and being willing to see its valid extension in whatever directions science takes us. The hope is that when it comes to dealing with humans whose behaviors are among our worst and most damaging, words like evil and soul will be as irrelevant as when considering a car with faulty brakes, that they will be as rarely spoken in a courtroom as in an auto repair shop. And crucially, the analogy holds in a key way, extending to instances of dangerous people without anything obviously wrong with their frontal cortex, genes, and so on. When a car is being dysfunctional and dangerous, and we take it to a mechanic, this is not a dualistic situation where, A, if the mechanic discovers some broken widget causing the problem, we have a mechanistic explanation. But B, if the mechanic can't find anything wrong, we're dealing with an evil car. Sure, the mechanic can speculate on the source of the problem. Maybe it's the blueprint from which the car was built. Maybe it was the building process. Maybe the environment contains some unknown pollutant that somehow impairs function. Maybe someday we'll have sufficiently powerful techniques in the auto shop to spot some key molecule in the engine that is out of whack. But in the meantime, we'll consider this car to be evil. Car, free will, also equals internal forces we do not understand yet. Footnote. Cars may soon be entering discussions of moral decision-making. When having to do one or the other, should a self-driving car smash itself into a wall, killing the passenger, in order to save 5 pedestrians? Most people think that is how such cars should be programmed, but predictably would prefer that one that they used make the opposite choice. Perhaps more expensive models will work that way, while the hoi polloi have more utilitarian cars. Or maybe the car will decide, based on how frequently you clean it and change its oil. Many who are viscerally opposed to this view charge that it is dehumanizing to frame damaged humans as broken machines. But as a final, crucial point, doing that is a hell of a lot more humane than demonizing and sermonizing them as sinners. Postscript. Now for the hard part. Well, so much for the criminal justice system. Now on to the really difficult part, which is what to do when someone compliments your zygomatic arches. If we deny free will when it comes to the worst of our behaviors, the same must also apply to the best. To our talents, displays of willpower and focus, moments of bursting creativity, decency, and compassion. Logically, it should seem as ludicrous to take credit for those traits as to respond to a compliment on the beauty of your cheekbones by thanking the person for implicitly having praised your free will, instead of explaining how mechanical forces acted upon the zygomatic arches of your skull. It will be so difficult to act that way. I am willing to admit that I have acted egregiously in this regard. My wife and I have brunch with a friend who serves fruit salad. We proclaim, "Wow, the pineapple is delicious." "They're out of season," our host smugly responds. "But I lucked out and found a decent one." My wife and I express awestruck worship. "You really know how to pick fruit. You are a better person than we are." We are praising the host for this supposed display of free will, for the choice made at the fork in life's road that is pineapple choosing. But we're wrong. In reality, genes had something to do with the olfactory receptors our host has that help detect ripeness. Maybe our host comes from a people whose deep and ancient cultural values include learning how to feel up a pineapple to tell if it's good. The sheer luck of the socioeconomic trajectory of our host's life has provided the resources to prowl an overpriced organic market playing Peruvian folk muzak. Yet we praise our host. I can't really imagine how to live your life as if there is no free will. It may never be possible to view ourselves as the sum of our biology. Perhaps we'll have to settle for making sure our homuncular myths are benign and save the heavy lifting of truly thinking rationally for where it matters. When we judge others harshly. Chapter 17. War and Peace. Let's review some facts. The amygdala typically activates when seeing a face of another race. If you're poor, by the time you're 5, your frontal cortical development probably lags behind average. Oxytocin makes us crappy to strangers. Empathy doesn't particularly translate into compassionate acts, nor does refined moral development translate into doing the harder, right thing. There are gene variants that, in particular settings, make you prone toward antisocial acts. And bonobos aren't perfectly peaceful. They wouldn't be masters of reconciliation if they didn't have conflicts to reconcile. All this makes one mighty pessimistic. Yet the rationale for this book is that, nonetheless, there's ground for optimism. Thus, this final chapter's goals are, A, to evidence that things have improved, that many of our worst behaviors are in retreat, our best ones ascendant. B, to examine ways to improve this further. C, to derive emotional support for this venture, to see that our best behaviors can occur in the most unlikely circumstances. D, and finally, to see if I can actually get away with calling this chapter War and Peace. Somewhat better angels. When it comes to our best and worst behaviors, the world is astonishingly different from that of the not-so-distant past. At the dawn of the 19th century, slavery occurred worldwide, including in the colonies of a Europe basking in the Enlightenment. Child labor was universal and would soon reach its exploitative golden age with the Industrial Revolution. And there wasn't a country that punished mistreatment of animals. Now, every nation has outlawed slavery, and most attempt to enforce that. Most have child labor laws, rates of child labor have declined, and it increasingly consists of children working alongside their parents in their homes. Most countries regulate the treatment of animals in some manner. The world is also safer. 15th century Europe averaged 41 homicides per 100,000 people per year. Currently, only El Salvador, Venezuela, and Honduras at 62, 64, and 85, respectively, are worse. The world averages 6.9. Europe averages 1.4, and there are Iceland, Japan, and Singapore at 0.3. Here are things that are rarer in recent centuries. Forced marriages, child brides, genital mutilation, wife beating, polygamy, widow burning, persecution of homosexuals, epileptics, albinos, beating of school children, beating of beasts of burden, rule of a land by an occupying army, by a colonial overlord, by an unelected dictator, illiteracy, death in infancy, death in childbirth, death from preventable disease, capital punishment. Here are things invented in the last century. Bans on the use of certain types of weapons. The World Court and the concept of crimes against humanity. The UN and the dispatching of multinational peacekeeping forces. International agreements to hinder trafficking of blood diamonds, elephant tusks, rhino horns, leopard skins, and humans. Agencies that collect money to aid disaster victims anywhere on the planet. That facilitate intercontinental adoption of orphans, that battle global pandemics and send medical personnel to any place of conflict. Yes, I know. I'm an utter naive if I think laws are universally enforced. For example, in 1981, Mauritania became the last country to ban slavery. Nevertheless, today, roughly 20% of its people are slaves, and the government has prosecuted a total of one slave owner. I recognize that little has changed in many places. I have spent decades in Africa living around people who believe that epileptics are possessed and that the organs of murdered albinos have healing powers, where beating of wives, children, and animals is the norm, five-year-olds herd cattle and haul firewood, pubescent girls are clitoridectomized and given to old men as third wives. Nonetheless, worldwide, things have improved. The definitive account of this is Pinker's monumental The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. It's a scholarly work that's gut-wrenchingly effective in documenting just how bad things once were. Pinker graphically describes the appalling historical inhumanity of humans. Roughly 500,000 people died in the Roman Colosseum to supply audiences of tens of thousands the pleasure of watching captives raped, dismembered, tortured, eaten by animals. Throughout the Middle Ages, armies swept across Eurasia, destroying villages, killing every man, consigning every woman and child to slavery. Aristocracy accounted for a disproportionate share of violence, savaging peasantry with impunity. Religious and governmental authorities, ranging from Europeans to Persians, Chinese, Hindus, Polynesians, Aztecs, Africans, and Native Americans invented means of torture. For a bored 16th century Parisian, entertainment might consist of a cat burning, execution of a criminal animal, or bear baiting, where a bear, chained to a post, would be torn apart by dogs. It is a sickeningly different world. Pinker quotes the writer L.P. Hartley. The past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. Better Angels has provoked three controversies. Why were people so awful then? For Pinker, the answer is clear. Because people had always been so awful. This is Chapter 9's debate. When war was invented, was ancestral hunter-gatherer life about Hobbes or Rousseau? As we saw, Pinker is in the camp holding that organized human violence predates civilization, stretching back to our last common ancestor with chimps. And as reviewed, most experts convincingly disagree, suggesting that data have been cherry-picked. Hunter-horticulturalists mislabeled as hunter-gatherers, and newfangled, sedentary hunter-gatherers inappropriately grouped with traditional nomadic ones. Why have people gotten less awful? Pinker's answer reflects two factors. He draws on the sociologist Norbert Elias, whose notion of the civilizing process centered on the fact that violence declines when states monopolize force. That is coupled with spread of commerce and trade, fostering realpolitik self-restraint, recognizing that it's better to have this other person alive and trading with you. Their well-being begins to matter, prompting what Pinker calls an escalator of reasoning, an enlarged capacity for empathy and usness. This underlies the rights revolution: civil rights, women's rights, children's rights, gay rights, animal rights. This view is a triumph of cognition. Pinker yokes this to the Flynn effect, the well-documented increase in average IQ over the last century. He invokes a moral Flynn effect, as increasing intelligence and respect for reasoning fuel better theory of mind and perspective-taking and an increased ability to appreciate the long-term advantages of peace. In the words of one reviewer, Pinker is not too faint-hearted to call his own culture civilized. Predictably, this has drawn fire from all sides. The left charges that this giddy overvaluing of the dead white male enlightenment fuels Western neo-imperialism. My personal political instincts run in this direction. Nonetheless, one must admit that the countries with minimal violence, extensive social safety nets, few child brides, numerous female legislators, and sacrosanct civil liberties are usually direct cultural descendants of the Enlightenment. Meanwhile, the right claims that Pinker ignores religion, pretending that decency was invented in the Enlightenment. He is eloquently unapologetic about this. For him, much of what has gone right reflects people's shifting from valuing souls to valuing lives. For others, the criticism is that escalator of reasoning fetishizes cognition over affect. After all, sociopaths have great theory of mind. A damage-induced, purely rational mind makes abhorrent moral judgments, and a sense of justice is fueled by the amygdala and insula, not the DLPFC. Obviously, this many pages into the book, I feel that the interaction of reasoning and feeling is key. Have people really gotten less awful? This has been very contentious. Pinker offers the soundbite, "We may be living in the most peaceful era in our species' existence." The fact most driving this optimism is that, except for the Balkan Wars, Europe has been at peace since 1945. The longest stretch in history. For Pinker, this long peace represents the West coming to its senses after the ruin of World War II, seeing how the advantages of being a common market outweigh those of being a perpetually warring continent, plus some expanding empathy thrown in on the side. Critics characterize this as Eurocentrism. Western countries may kumbaya one another, but they've sure made war elsewhere. France in Indochina and Algeria, Britain in Malaya and Kenya, Portugal in Angola and Mozambique, the USSR in Afghanistan, the United States in Vietnam, Korea, and Latin America. Moreover, parts of the developing world have been continuously at war for decades. Consider the Eastern Congo. Most important, such wars have been made bloodier because the West invented the idea of having client states fight proxy wars for them. After all, the late 20th century saw the United States and USSR arm the warring Somalia and Ethiopia, only to switch to arming the other side within a few years. The long peace has been for Westerners. The claim of violence declining steadily over the last millennium also must accommodate the entire bloody 20th century. World War II killed 55 million people, more than any conflict in history. Throw in World War I, Stalin, Mao, and the Russian and Chinese civil wars, and you're up to 130 million. Pinker does something sensible that reflects his being a scientist. He corrects for total population size. Thus, while the 8th century's An Lushan rebellion and civil war in Tang Dynasty China killed only 36 million, that represented one-sixth of the world's population, the equivalent of 429 million in the mid-20th century. When deaths are expressed as a percentage of total population, World War II is the only 20th century event cracking the top 10, behind An Lushan, the Mongol conquests, the Mideast slave trade, the fall of the Ming Dynasty, the fall of Rome, the deaths caused by Tamerlane, the annihilation of Native Americans by Europeans, and the Atlantic slave trade. Critics have questioned this. Hey, stop using fudge factors to somehow make World War II's 55 million dead less than the fall of Rome's 8 million. After all, 9/11's murders would not have evoked only half as much terror if America had 600 million instead of 300 million citizens. But Pinker's analysis is appropriate, and analyzing rates of events is how you discover that today's London is much safer than was Dickens's, or that some hunter-gatherer groups have homicide rates that match Detroit's. But Pinker failed to take things one logical step further, also correcting for differing durations of events. Thus he compares the half-dozen years of World War II with, for example, 12 centuries of the Mideast slave trade and 4 centuries of Native American genocide. When corrected for duration as well as total world population,